KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Oh, hello. Well, I'm from the Temescal, where it's always sunny.
Southside, Berkeley.
Santa Clara, California.
Coming up, our series on the Oakland mayoral election continues with candidate Saeed Karamouz.
The only obstacle standing between what the people of Oakland deserve and what they currently have is a dysfunctional government.
Then we'll remember the Olympic Black Power salute 50 years later with one of the men who raised their fists, John Carlos.
People say, you sound like you still running, sound like you still got the fire.
And we find out what sideshows in East Oakland are all about.
It was cats who were working on their cars. They would go out and display what they have done to their cars to hype them up.
Stay tuned, Cross Currents is coming up. Oakland businessman Saeed Karamouz was a senior executive in the tech industry and worked with Fortune 100 companies. These days, he's running a skincare company with his wife and running for Oakland mayor. Karamouz met up with KALW's Janae Darden at Lake Merritt. He tells her why he wants to take care of business in the top job at City Hall.
With this election, I noticed there's so much about what's going wrong with Oakland. What's going well with Oakland?
It's a lot going right with Oakland. Oakland has the most authentic community, the most diverse community I've ever lived in. The artistic, creative, you know, presence is amazing. Oakland is untouchable when it comes to those kinds of things. My observation has been is the only obstacle standing between what the people of Oakland deserve and what they currently have is a dysfunctional government.
And you've been here, you've lived here, you're originally from Iran, and you've lived here about 40 years. And one of the concerns that people are concerned about, you named all these great things happening in Oakland, and people are worried that we're losing that. How are you going to keep that going if elected?
We have to make that a priority. Everything happens when you make it a priority, when you allocate resources and budget to it. I have been very, very specific on the approach that I would take. It's a $75 million program consisting of three equal amounts of $25 million towards education, $25 million towards jobs, and $25 million towards housing. That is intended to lift our community up in a way that supports everyone and addresses far beyond just the symptoms of the problem. We will have addressed homelessness, we will have addressed illegal dumping, we will have addressed public safety, and a number of other things when we invest in jobs, education, and housing.
$75 million. Now, some people may be thinking, who are Oakland residents, do I have to pay for that? Does that mean more taxes?
It does not mean more taxes. $75 million represents 7.5% of our annual budget. 7.5%. But there are easily $30 to $50 million that can be recouped by virtue of the unfunded OPD overtime that is on top of the already $250 million per year that the OPD spends. On top of that, we spend another $10 to $15 million per year in the federal oversight fees that we have to pay for them every 90 days to come in and check on us because we are still under federal oversight under the negotiated settlement agreement, and the police abuse and brutality lawsuit settlements that we pay. So really, right there, we have somewhere between $30 and $50 million that we could easily save if we run our Oakland Police Department with more care, with more discipline, and with more transparency.
So part of that $75 million, housing.
So I have a three-stage program, which starts with an immediate program, which is almost a zero cost. Literally, I would leave the doors to public buildings, like the City Hall, like the Oakland's Police Department's headquarters, parks, other facilities around town, leave those bathrooms open for our brothers and sisters who are on the streets each night and all weekend to use a facility that is dignified. On top of that, I would, again in the immediate program, would entail mobile hygiene services, so showers, laundry services, so we could go to them so they can you know, take care of their hygiene needs. And then I would include as well storage facilities, because a big complaint of the homeless community is that when they leave for the day, their stuff gets stolen throughout the day. They need storage facilities. And finally, a place to receive physical mail. They need a mailing address. If you want a job, you need a mailing address. So I would take care of those on day one. Literally, within weeks, those things will be done. Right? So that's stage two. Stage three is take on a construction project that will give us publicly funded housing with the exact same construction specifications, meaning material, workmanship, design, the whole thing as market rate home, with the exception of corporate and investor and developer greed. It's not the cost of housing, it's not the cost of land and the building that's driving the prices out of reach, it's the greed. It's the market conditions and the demand that our high-earning tech workers are bringing into our city that's causing our local people to get displaced.
I was talking to a family member, and she was looking at all of the cranes going up. We were driving around Oakland, and she said, I'm afraid I'm not going to see the sky one day. Can we have development and still have maintain those natural environmental spaces that we enjoy in Oakland?
Yes, if you're thoughtful. Whoever you were speaking with is 100% right. Once we lose the sky, there is no getting it back.
Or even the grass, you know.
Or even the grass, right? Just very, very quickly, go to some cities, and they have like a signing ordinance. And you go to a city, and you don't see a single McDonald's arches, right? And you notice that they have chosen to be thoughtful about what their city looks like. We can do exact same thought and approach and standard for how you build and what size buildings you build around our city.
Last question. Why should people vote for you?
When people consider their options, my structured approach, if you will, is to look for someone who they can trust, someone who has a vision for Oakland, and someone who has had the know-how and the experience to bring that vision into reality. I am in this race for the people of Oakland. If they choose me and I am their mayor, I promise they will not be disappointed.
That was Oakland mayoral candidate Saeed Karamuz. KALW's Janae Darden is speaking with all 10 candidates. Find links to those conversations at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Today marks the 50th anniversary of one of the most significant scenes in sports and civil rights history. On October 16, 1968, U.S. Olympians Tommy Smith and John Carlos ran the 200-meter sprint fast enough to medal at the Summer Games in Mexico City. When the San Jose State alumni stepped up on the podium to hear the national anthem, they bowed their heads and raised their fists in the air. It was an act of civil disobedience, and it almost never happened. The men had actually considered boycotting the games to call attention to racial injustice. A few years ago, John Carlos sat down with, to the best of our knowledge, host Steve Paulson, and we got permission to play part of that conversation for you right now.
I told Tommy at the quarter semi, after the quarter semi was over, we had a discussion, and I told him I was disenchanted about the fact that the boycott was called off. And I felt like I wanted to make a statement. What's your take on that? He said, I'm with you. From that point on, we started talking about what artifacts we had we could bring to the table, which was the black gloves, which was a black scarf, which I had a black shirt. I had beads. We decided we would wear black socks out there with our pants rolled up. We had no shoes out there. And each and every one of these symbols had a specific meaning, and if you bear me the time, I'll explain them to you. The black glove was based on the fact that we felt when with an open fist. There's five people of color, and each one of them are very sharp, have a very strong paradigm as to how things could be better. But either one of them step out on his own to move a pebble. He couldn't move it. But then when you say, all right, the next time we come together and say we have a unified vision as to how we can make things better, such as a possibly a boycott or what have you, and all these people come together in a very powerful force, well, you couldn't move a pebble by yourself. Now, unified, you can move a mountain. That was a concept of the fist and the glove. The scarf on Tommy's neck was to show black pride. I had a black shirt over my USA jersey to indicate that there was sorrow about the fact that we had to go to this extent to get America to wake up and realize its misdeeds in society. Then we decided that the beads that I had on my neck would be for all of the lynchings that had taken place that I've read about and heard about as a young kid coming up in this great country of ours. And then we wore no shoes with long black socks to indicate those individuals that was in the South at that particular time, and I'm sure they're still there today, walking to and from 10, 20 miles to school without shoes. We wore the Puma shoe, or we put the Puma shoe out there merely because the Puma shoe was a shoe that was a concern about people of color that didn't have the means to go out and buy the proper shoes, but they was very kind-hearted to give individual shoes before they even got a reputation.
So you did all this. I mean, it's sort of extraordinary what you're describing. The symbolism there is overpowering. You got the bronze. Tommy got the gold. Peter Norman from Australia got the silver. All up on the podium there. And then when they started playing the Star Spangled Banner, you and Tommy raised your fists.
As we walked out, I mentioned to Tommy that, hey, man, you remember when we go out there, I said, people are going to be applauding, and then there's going to be a void, and that void would be total silence because they would be in a state of shock once we started to perform our deeds. And at the same time, I told Tommy, remember, we've been threatened. Our lives have been threatened. So remember this, man.
Well, why had you been threatened?
Well, based on the fact that we was proposing an Olympic boycott. They felt it was anti-American, you know, and many of the haters out there didn't particularly like the fact that you would step back. They feel that, oh, we giving you this honor. No, you didn't give me an honor. You set a standard. I took the honor to step up and qualify to make the Olympic team. I want America to represent young individuals in regards to what their ethnic background is as much as these young individuals honor America. That's what our stand was then. That's what my stand is today. So when we went out there, I told Tommy, be careful, man. We've been trained to listen to the gun. If you hear the gun, hit the deck. We went out there, we put the shoe down on the victory stand as they acknowledged us. Tommy, I believe, raised his glove and the shoe on his foot up to the spectators. And then when we received our medals and we turned to the right to the flag and they started to sing the national anthem, and then we come out with the gloves and raise our fist to the sky. And it's just like I said, this void came over to the point where it was silent for a matter of seconds. And then it went from silence to total screaming of the national anthem. It's almost like they were singing the national anthem in a sense that we're going to shove this American national anthem down your throats whether you want it or not.
And then you got booed, right?
Oh, it was a tremendous amount of boos.
What was the fallout for you personally? I mean, for starters, just as an athlete, weren't you kind of ostracized by the track and field establishment?
Well, I was ostracized to a sense, you know, but I wasn't weak enough that they could run me away. I decided that I was going to run for 2 years, and I always thought about how they tried and slammed down our throats that national anthem, and I wanted to slam down their throats that I was going to be the best in the world. Anybody you bring, I was going to wear them out for you to let them know I'm here to run, and I'm here for anybody you want to bring against me. But yet and still, you know, I had aches and pains relative to the demonstration. I would say that probably the most important thing that was most hurting or disturbing to me when my first wife took her life as a result of the Olympics, the pressures that were put upon us, the lack of money into our household, the contempt that came into our household.
No, and you should elaborate on that because, I mean, reading your book, the FBI followed you.
Oh,
they would plant rumors about you. You
put
got
rumors
death threats.
Out. Well, it's no different than what they do today to anyone. They did the same thing to Dr. King. And then at the same time, my kids had to endure ridicule in school merely because when the teachers found out they were my kids. So I had to endure all of these things. I remember I had to get $100 here, $200 there, and get somebody to drive me to Vegas just so I could roll the dice to pay my mortgage. 29 days out of the month. If it was 30 days, I'm working 29 days to get my mortgage payment so my kids wouldn't live in the street. And I remember chopping up my furniture, taking my kids and tell them, take your clothes out of the bureau drawer and put it on the floor there. And I would go take a claw hammer and chop that furniture up and go put it in the fireplace because I could not pay my electric bill. I didn't have groceries. I had some dear friends that came and said, John, I don't have much, but I see you don't have nothing in your cabinets, and came and put food in my house. Many individuals walked away from me at that particular time that I thought was my friends. It took me a minute to find out that they walked away not because of disrespect or dislove. The majority of them walked away for fear of reprisal. If you was associated with John Collins, what's happening to him can come and happen to you as well.
Did you ever have any regrets for what you did back in Mexico City?
No regrets whatsoever. And if it was necessary for me to step up tomorrow, I would never hesitate to step up for what I feel is right. People say, you sound like you're still running. Sound like you still got the fire. Well, the fire was with me when I came. The fire being with me when I left, until justice is brought here for all men, women, and children on this planet. Someone has to step up in order to make it better. What good is my life being here if I'm here and I got kids and grandkids coming into this world, and I'm in a position where I could bring attention to something to try and make us solve this problem or make it a better situation, and now I'm getting ready to leave and I haven't done anything to try and make a better life for my kids or their kids? That's what it's about.
That's John Carlos speaking with, to the best of our knowledge, host Steve Paulson. 50 years ago today, Carlos raised his fist in the air with Tommy Smith at the Olympic Games in Mexico City. You can see that moment commemorated in a statue on the San Jose State University campus. And the book he referenced is The John Carlos Story, The Sports Moment That Changed the World. Find a link at KELW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. For the past year, KELW has focused in on East Oakland. We've hosted live community events, we've partnered with neighborhood journalists through the Oakland Voices program, and taken our collaborative journalism project, Hey Area, there to answer your questions about East Oakland. One area of East Oakland culture that's gotten a lot of interest has been the sideshow. The sideshow is a car culture movement born in Oakland, where people build up and engineer their cars and sound systems, then go out to display their work in the streets and parking lots of Oakland. And some people asked our Hey Area East Oakland project what the origins of the sideshow are. And though we weren't able to find a definitive answer, we did talk to someone who knows. In the recent movie Blindspotting, set in Oakland, there is the scene at a parking lot sideshow party by Lake Merritt. The man behind the turntables at that party is Derek Sharp Robinson, better known as DJ D Sharp, an Oakland native and DJ for the Golden State Warriors. Oakland Voices graduate Damu Daly met up with D Sharp to go through his memories of the sideshow.
D Sharp grew up in East Oakland.
I lived on 51st and Bancroft. And in the time of the crack era, East Oakland, it was popping. I'm talking about, it was crazy. Like, I look back at that shit and I be like, damn, I'm still alive. Like, it was like that, you know what I mean?
He has some vivid memories of that time, and they all came pouring out when I asked just one simple question about growing up in Oakland. Have you ever seen a sideshow?
Always, right in front of my house. Like, I mean, yeah, all the time. Yeah. So it's like, you know, going out and just being out, being so young, and then like seeing like Seville's pull up, just slapping.
He describes a sideshow like this.
I feel like when we was coming up, at least, it was cats who were working on their cars, and then they would go out and display what they have done to their cars to hype them up. You know what I mean? at an intersection and people would gather.
Brightly colored, old school classic cars would float down the street, shiny and freshly painted. I remember it from when I was a kid in Oakland. The sound systems would vibrate the streets. Car trunks would be packed with speakers, 10-inch, 12-inch, 15-inch. Eventually, you could tell whose car it was by the song playing from blocks away. One car in particular sticks out in D-Sharp's mind.
Dude opened the trunk and he got, you know, I remember this cat had 10 tens. He popped his trunk open in a Seville. He had 10 tens in the back of it. And it was, till this day, I can't think of another car that I've ever heard slam that hard. It was 10 tens, 10 subwoofers, and it was perfect in the back. It was like, it was insane. Oddly enough, you know a song he was playing? He was playing the Soul Train, the Soul Train theme. Bow, 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 bow. That thing, it was pounding so hard. And everything he played after that was all like, it really wasn't no rap. Everything he was playing was like SOS band and just like, it was like stuff that like, was like, no, yeah, Bootsy Collins, like, no one's gonna love you. Bo, 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 bo. Like, just knocking super hard. And that's one of the, actually, that's the most vivid I remember. And I always, after that, I wanted a Seville.
He wanted a four-door Cadillac Seville, and he knew exactly what kind of speakers he'd get for it.
I wanted a four-door Seville. I was like, I could do it with 412s, you know what I mean? That was my thing. I was like, if I got 412s, this is me at 10 years old, by the way. If I got 412s with a Seville, I'd be knocking, you know what I mean? So,
knocking, slapping, popping, bumping, banging, cracking. Oakland natives like D-Sharp creatively repurposed words to describe cars and their speaker systems. Terms for beautiful greatness in Oakland sideshow lingo.
And then you had certain cats who come through just flashy and just pull up and just, you know, like Rich was known for that, just pulling up, slamming hard and shutting the sideshow down. Oh man, he just show up and just his presence, that orange, what was it, the Cutlass. Okay. Just pull up, just shut it down, you know what I mean?
Like, really,
oh man.
He's talking about Richie Rich, like, a local artist who made a classic sideshow anthem called The Sideshow. And if you listen to how D-Sharp says flashy or shut it down, he can make you feel like you're right there with him, watching the streets begin to peak as local celebrities pull up in their cars.
It's a Saturday night, my girl's looking real pretty, but oh man, what? And he was like, I mean, as far as I can remember coming up, I mean, Rich was like, in terms of car culture in Oakland, he had some legendary cars. Like some real legendary cars. Like you can go back to it and point it out. And Rich and Indian Tone has some legendary cars too.
Indian Tone is a mythical figure of the sideshow who competed with people like Richie Rich for the unofficial title of the Sideshow Champion.
Indian Tone had Cougars and Mustangs and Chevs, like he had Chevelles, he probably holds the title.
Oakland kids of D-Sharp's era would debate about this type of thing often.
Yep, I would. It's between him and Rich. I mean, just through my eyes coming up in East Oakland, you know what I mean? It could be other cats, but like, I mean, I've seen like, yeah, like Indian Tone had he had a Cougar. That thing was like just pristine, you know what I mean? Like the detail that went into like putting that car together, you know what I mean? It's like showroom level. Then he probably got it done in East Oakland somewhere, you know what I mean?
As for where the sideshow originally began in Oakland, many still wonder. The most qualified answer I could find was from Dwayne Wiggins of Tony Tony Tony, who began his musical career with his brother Raphael Sadiq in the churches of East Oakland during the 70s and early 80s. He responded online to answer the question of where the sideshow started. He said in a Facebook post, 81st and East 14th in the Quarter Pounder parking lot. But the answers vary depending on who you're talking to and what era they came up in. A lot of people say where it really entered the mainstream popularity was later, in the late 80s, around Eastmont Mall near Bancroft at the McDonald's parking lot. You may not have. Really, a sideshow is like a pop-up shop. They can open and close on any corner, so people remember them in all kinds of places, like Foothill Square, the Coliseum, or right by the lake. Wherever it began, Oakland sideshow culture is here to stay, at least in memory and influence alone. From Marshawn Lynch's post-game golf cart celebrations on Cal's football field, later captured in a bobblehead doll, to the Golden State Warriors' use of the phrase, the town, on its official NBA jerseys. From the opening scene of the hit Marvel movie Black Panther, which featured In the Trunk, Too Short's classic sideshow song, to then-Oakland Mayor Jerry Brown's 2005 attempt to jail people within 100 feet of it. The sideshow, its language, its music, its DJs, its fashion, its car culture, they're all part of Oakland's history of creating innovative movement. But unfortunately, this car culture, created by people of color, doesn't necessarily get the respect that others do in America, like NASCAR or monster trucks, for example. Imagine if it did. Maybe the city could help young people learn a trade, start a business with the cars they produce, or put on city-sanctioned car competitions. So in closing, dance with the one who brought you Oakland and support the ones who made the dances and the music and the car culture you love so much. Sideways to the next light in my pop's Cadillac DeVille. This is Damu Daily for Cross Currents.
That story was a collaboration between Oakland Voices and KELW as part of our project Hey Area and the Sights and Sounds of East Oakland. And if you want to make sure to not miss any Cross Currents content, make sure to subscribe to our weekly newsletter to get your context, culture, and connection all in your inbox. Thanks for listening. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.